media sponsor for this event.
Hi, I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host of Uprising. KPFK's next fund drive is from February 12th through the 26th as we raise funds to keep this beacon of media democracy alive. We'll be sharing with you the best books, films, and speeches we can get our hands on. And we hope you can join us either as a donor or a volunteer or both. We especially need volunteers to answer phones during the morning shifts. If you're interested, call us at 818-985-2711, extension 513. That's 818-985-2711, extension 513. Or visit us online at kpfk.org and click on the volunteer button for the schedule. For the real news on this year's presidential elections, you know you can count on KPFK. And we know we can count on you, the listener, to make it all possible.
Good afternoon, I'm Patrick Burke, here with an update from the KPFK newsroom. The time is 3 o'clock. Thousands of civilians have been fleeing the capital of Chad today, fearing a resumption of violence between rebels and state forces. Armed opponents to President Idriss Deby besieged the capital over the weekend. According to Doctors Without Borders, hundreds of civilians have been wounded. The government tells AFP that its forces pushed the rebels out of the city, while rebel leaders insist that they made a strategic withdrawal. The Sudanese government is denying Chadian claims that it has been supporting the rebels, making the reciprocal allegation that Deby has supported rebels in Darfur. The World Food Program says the fighting could disrupt food aid to more than 400,000 Sudanese refugees and displaced Chadians. President Bush has submitted a record federal budget of $3.1 trillion, including a 7.5% increase in military spending. It proposes $515 billion for the Pentagon, plus a preliminary request of $70 billion for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bush wants to cut or terminate over 150 programs, a third of which are from the Education Department. He also wants to increase spending labeled national security. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says today's budget is fiscally irresponsible and highly deceptive. Opinion polls show Barack Obama catching up with Hillary Clinton ahead of tomorrow's cluster of contests. A new Reuters C-SPAN Zogby survey suggests that Obama has reversed what had been a double-digit Clinton advantage in California and has taken a six-point lead of his own. State Democratic structures will allot delegates proportionally rather than giving one candidate the whole statewide prize. That means decent showings by Obama and Clinton across the country could keep the race close after the biggest day so far in the process. New polls from Gallup, the Pew Research Center, and the Washington Post ABC News give John McCain a 2-1 lead nationally over Mitt Romney, but according to the Reuters C-SPAN Zogby poll, the Olympics organizer has taken a lead over McCain here in California. We'll have more in the evening newscast at 6 and another update at 4. Stay tuned now for Indie Media On Air.
I like making you so happy.
Yo, life in debt. Light a cigarette, smoke the stress. Take a deep breath, baby. Let's rearrange the mess we've inherited. Alienated from what is rightfully yours and mine. Land is life, money is time. Paid for labor. Working 8 to 5, sometimes 6, 7, 8. We come home and barely know the neighbors. Bills are usually late. Interest accumulates at a usury rate. Collection agency waits from paycheck to next.
Welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett. Today, we will be talking with Dr. Stephen Jones and Richard Gage on the topic of 9/11, taking a scientific approach to the collapse of all three high-rise buildings. We will be looking at the evidence that supports a controlled demolition hypothesis, and what is the current state of research on this issue? What is NIST up to, and where is the 9/11 movement heading? I should mention that both my guests today will be appearing in Los Angeles on Saturday, February 23rd, at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, located at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. Seating for that event begins at 5 p.m., and Cynthia McKinney will address the audience regarding her support for a new 9/11 investigation. Information on discounted pre-sale tickets is available by calling 805-653-1588. Richard Gage, AIA, is the founding member of AE911Truth.org. He has been a practicing architect for 20 years and has worked on most types of building construction, including numerous fireproof steel frame buildings. He is employed with a San Francisco Bay Area architecture firm and has most recently performed construction administration services for a new $120 million high school campus, including a $10 million steel-framed gymnasium. He currently is working on the design development for a very large mixed-use urban project that includes about 1,200 tons of steel framing. Stephen Jones, professor of physics, retired, has published papers in Scientific American, Nature, and Physical Review Letters. His peer-reviewed paper on the collapse of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers when only two were hit by airplanes has been widely read and has been translated into Spanish, French, and Japanese. It is available at www.journalof911studies.com, along with about 100 other scholarly papers regarding the events of 9/11. His ongoing research includes experiments with thermites, along with electron microscope energy dispersive spectrographic analyses of dust from the WTC collapses. Now, as many in this audience know, Indie Media on Air has done quite a few stories on this topic, and as I stay with this story, I've noticed repeatedly that those that defend the official version of events are routinely incapable of defending them, in my opinion, especially in light of the evidence presented by Dr. Jones, Richard Gage, and others associated with their respective websites. I've heard numerous debates between supporters of the official story and critics alike, and I am amazed at the supporters' inability to defend the official version. And I know that many still shy away from the topic, and for many reasons, but I've made the argument repeatedly that the issue of 9/11 is one that has mobilized and politicized millions of people. And it is a potential organizer's dream to tap into this movement and understand why it tends to break down or break open traditional political barriers and allows for communication across the political spectrum. And for those of you that know this show and Indie Media's politics in general, I certainly personally reject the xenophobia and the status politics that one might occasionally find in a 9/11 truth movement. But I think it's essential for all of us to open our hearts and minds to the potential political watershed. And sadly, I found too often that those that seek mainstream credibility as a left liberal pundit or academic are more afraid than anyone to touch 9/11, perhaps because of job security or the need for access, I don't know. But I do think these rejections of the 9/11 movement speak to deeper issues of alignment with institutional power and privilege, and one that is not easy to break, let alone even be acknowledged. However, I think it's imperative we listen to the arguments made that scientifically and otherwise challenge the official 9/11 narrative, especially because 9/11 was so clearly and meticulously exploited to advance a domestic and imperial agenda. And to that end, I'm very, very happy to have Dr. Stephen Jones and Richard Gage on the show today. Thank you both for joining me on Indie Media On Air.
Glad to be here with you, Chris.
And definitely Richard here, and hello, Stephen.
Hi, Richard.
Well, so you both will be in Los Angeles on the 23rd. Why don't you tell us about the event coming up and what you hope to present? Richard, let's start with you.
Well, we have a lot of very, very interesting information to present to the people of Los Angeles. It is a wake-up call. We now have 260 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation of the collapses on 9/11 of the three World Trade Center high-rise buildings. And I say three because most of us are only familiar with the two twin towers, but there was a third building that came down that day that we're going to be talking about. And so the evidence for controlled demolition for all three of these buildings is overwhelming. And very specifically to the heart of the matter goes our other guest, Stephen Jones, into the chemistry, the physical evidence of the chemical evidence of the cutter charges, thermite. So it's going to be a very interesting discussion today.
And Dr. Jones, why don't you give us a little bit of a breakdown on what you hope to present?
Okay, thank you. Well, I've been very pleased as I travel around speaking to groups about 9/11 research, how many people are interested in the scientific studies that we're doing. Hard physical evidence is what people seem to really respond to, and that's what I'm looking for, too, and have looked for and found over the past 3 years, just about 3 years now since I jumped into this research. And in particular, I'll show microscope images, photographs through the microscope of these spheres that we've found in the dust. There are many spheres which, see, if you spray water into the air, the water forms droplets because of the surface tension in the liquid. And I guess the air is cold enough, those would freeze into little ice spheres. Well, the same thing happens with metals. If you spray them into the air somehow, they will form into spheres. And from that spherical shape, we know that the metal was once molten. Of course, in this case, we're finding molten iron and molybdenum and some other species in the dust that imply extremely high temperatures and tell us a lot about what happened, what really happened on 9/11. The dust is just full of this information that is preserved as to how these spheres were formed, what they came from. And that's what I'll be talking about. I'll try to lighten it up with some other information, too, people looking at other things. But to me, the science is just fascinating. You know, BBC was here last week, and we went down into the electron microscope lab, and I showed them the images of the spheres. And they were very interested, of course. And, you know, I find that people are. They can understand, you know, spheres, how do they get there in the dust? There's so many of them. How were they produced, and what does this mean?
Right. And I want to get into that in the details of why the temperature is so important. What I would like to ask both of you first, and imagine in our audience there's somebody listening who is new to this. What I would like to ask you both to do, if you can, briefly, is if just give that person who's listening who's not familiar with some of these really basic arguments that are being presented by both of you, what are some of the top points you would want to make to this person who coming into this needs to know? What are the key points that point to controlled demolition and other issues that have been developed by the 9/11 activists? And Richard, let's go back to you.
Yeah, and this context for the work that Dr. Jones has delved into. Well, first of all, we have all of the same characteristics in this third building, Building 7, of a classic controlled demolition, beginning with a rapid onset with explosions at the base, heard by several witnesses, a sound of a clap of thunder, they described it. One witness, Kevin McPadden, hears a countdown on a radio held by a Red Cross worker. 3, 2, 1, and then he hears this big kaboom. Well, this indicates foreknowledge. Now, buildings don't collapse as a result of countdowns, naturally. And then what happens is we have a rapid, symmetrical free fall, virtually, of the building, starting with it. Well, you can see its perimeter at the top, its parapet, drops very, very classically with a kink in the middle in the manner of a controlled demolition. Now, this is like a house of cards falling down at free fall speed against the 40,000 tons of structural steel designed to resist that load. In addition, it falls in a classic implosion at the base, 47 stories falling into a four-story pile. This can only be done if all of the steel members are cut. And indeed, we have evidence of them being cut by FEMA, documented intergranular melting at the ends of these beams, rapid oxidation, sulfidation, and they find what almost amounts to chemical evidence of thermate. We just need to do a little bit more research on it to find the actual aluminum, which is one of the other key pieces of evidence for thermate. So we have easily the third worst structural failure in the history of modern buildings, and the other two being the Twin Towers, which we'll get to in a moment. And yet we have no mention of it in the 9/11 Commission report whatsoever. And what does NIST do, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, with this very important information documented by FEMA in Appendix C for the melting of these steel girders into Swiss cheese, like gaping holes some larger than a silver dollar, they describe it and photograph it. This throws all of this valuable evidence out, critical forensic evidence. They throw it out, and it is not even included in their subsequent reports. and they've been dallying now for 6 years, and we're told that the final report on Building 7 won't even come out until July. Well, I just gave my comments on NIST directly on December 18th.
You know, Richard, actually, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the phone is really breaking up. What I'd like to do is ask Dr. Jones to give his response, and hang up, and our producer is going to call you back and try and get a better, cleaner line. And also on that note, we do have that audio that you from your presentation to NIST, which I'd like to play in a little bit. So, Dr. Jones, why don't we get a response from you and what would you would like to present to that person who's coming to this for the first time?
Right. Well, you know, it depends a little on the person. As we talk about how do you feel about the Bush-Cheney administration, I'd like to kind of get a sense of where they're starting from. People around here, a lot of people are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, and I have to sort of start with, well, are you willing to look at some scientific facts? Or I'll start with a discussion of the North American Union. So, something to get, to break the ice a little bit. So, because often when you start talking about 9/11, there's this barrier that goes up. Oh, couldn't possibly be. I mean, we elected Bush and Cheney. They're wonderful, you know, that sort of thing. And so I try to find out, first of all, who I'm talking to and their attitudes and go from there. But once we get into 9/11, there are four areas I like to discuss. One is World Trade Center 7. As Richard went through some of those details. The second has to do with the evidence for the use of thermite. I mean, if someone says, well, if they used explosives, there has to be a residue. And I say, yes, we look for that residue. NIST admits they did not look for the residue of explosives, but we did, and we found it. And then I'll talk to them about the microspheres, the aluminum, iron, microspheres, and so on. Let's see, the third area I like to talk to people about is the testimony of Secretary Mineta as he talked to the 9/11 Commission. And perhaps we could go into that, but I think many of the listeners, I hope, are aware that there's three papers, I think, in the Journal of 9/11 Studies about this testimony, very revealing, where Cheney knew that a plane was approaching the Pentagon over a period of time, and yet nothing was done to stop that plane. So this testimony is, I think, very indicative of information that was had on 9/11, and nothing was done to prevent the hit on the Pentagon. And then the fourth thing I like to talk about is the money made with put options on United Airlines and American Airlines. Now, a put is a bet that the stock's going to go down. And, of course, the stocks on those two airlines did drop precipitously after 9/11, since those are the two involved in the attacks. So someone made a lot of money by placing these put options. And the 9/11 Commission did look into this. In a footnote, they say, yes, certainly there were some very unusual trades made in just this five trading days now prior to 9/11. So these put options on these airlines. And someone made a lot of money. And then they say, we traced it out and determined this is not due to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda did not make the money. And therefore, this is 9/11 Commission's term, therefore these trades were innocuous. And that shows so much. It shows that the 9/11 Commission had blinkers on. I mean, they don't care about anything but Al-Qaeda. But it also shows that some group or persons, in addition to Al-Qaeda, was involved, you see, and made a lot of money. So it gets into the issue of motive. And there's a lot of evidence.
I want to remind listeners that the websites to look at are journalof911studies.com and ae911truth.org. The papers, the scholarly papers that are published at journalof911studies.com, number in about 100.
Right.
There's a lot of scientists there, physicists, chemists, engineers, et cetera, and you should go there and read these papers.
Great.
But the point about the metal spheres, as well as the spectrographic analysis, the stuff that I find to be the most interesting as well.
Good.
That The issue really comes down to temperatures. And,
right.
One issue, important issue, is temperatures, and that it's mm-hmm. really important to point out that a hydrocarbon fire could not possibly reach the temperatures necessary to make metal molten, because that's in the 4,000 degree range.
Well, these metals.
These particular metals.
Yeah. I mean, aluminum melts more easily, but not iron. Yeah, and so that's this latest paper in the Journal of 9/11 Studies that I and, gosh, there's five PhDs on the paper.
I actually have, you have people from physics departments, from BYU, from University mm-hmm. of Maryland.
University of Iowa,
et cetera.
Right. So a good group of guys, and what we focused on there was just, first of all, we start where we agree with NIST. NIST did a thorough study on the temperatures associated with the World Trade Center fires, and a maximum of about 1,000 to 1,100 centigrade. I'll use centigrade because that's what I use as a scientist. And I can convert later if you want. And then the temperatures required to produce these spheres, so to melt iron and iron oxide and molybdenum. Now, molybdenum is a refractory metal, so these are very high temperatures. We're talking about, you've got the paper before you.
I don't have it in front of me, but it's...
I could pull it up, but it's over 2,000 centigrade for molybdenum, over 1,500 for iron and iron oxide, whereas the fires reached a maximum of 1,000 to 1,100 C. And I looked at three different sources. There are others. They all agree the maximum temperature associated with the World Trade Center fires is about 1,100. And so you just can't get there in order to produce these molten iron oxide and molybdenum.
Right. And there's something essentially that's going to be a highly exothermic reaction.
Right.
And, and one of the beliefs is that it's thermates or some
type
of thermate.
So, that's right. And exactly. Yep. It's a very powerful argument. I think it's extremely well-founded, hard to refute. Especially when NIST comes back and says, well, we just did not look for residues of explosives.
And Dr. Jones, there's one...
And they also say that they didn't find it.
And then
when asked, well, how could you find it if you didn't look for it? They say, well, why would we look for something that's not there?
That's right.
It's a circular argument that just it holds no water.
Yeah.
But let me just give a little more context here, Chris, for Dr. Jones's work. The iron workers and the first responders and even the World Trade Center structural engineer, Leslie Robertson, all discussed these tons of molten metal. The firemen said flowing like lava down in the channel rails, you know, down in the basements. It's all flowing down here. Well, if you had thousands of incendiary cutter charges, remember thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. You have thousands of these charges throughout the beams and columns in the buildings, and they go off timed with the about an hour after the airplane hit, from the point of the airplane impact, and then down as well as up. The byproduct of this aluminothermic reaction is indeed molten iron, as well as iron oxide, aluminum oxide, which comes off as a white gas, which is also seen.
And so sulfur is present.
Sorry?
And sulfur is present, which would reduce the temperature at which the steel
right.
would melt.
That, and the sulfur is documented by FEMA on the ends of these beams, and they had no idea where it came from. The New York Times calls it the greatest mystery of all. So that's the only possible production of this tons of molten iron, and it's not molten steel, which is commonly aired. It's molten iron. That can't be produced. I mean, the steel has chromium and other alloys in it. So where do these tiny spheres come from? Well, if you have these thousands of charges and the particles are small enough, as Dr. Jones will explain, they have an explosive quality called nanothermite. The pressure puts this molten iron, much of it, into the air as these tiny droplets that he's talking about. The rest of it drops down in greater quantities down in the basement where it's seen and pulled up by these tractors, molten still, and much of it afterward. They call them meteorites. They're already cooled.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask Dr. Jones, this is something I'm very curious about, and how do you ensure the integrity of the samples you're collecting for research? And I know from experience this is a very big issue for scientists. On the one hand, you have to be able to provide other scientists the opportunity to duplicate your results, and on the other, the integrity issue will be attacked by supporters of the official theory if it isn't done carefully.
Right. So what we've done there, Chris, is to, in all cases, I've asked collectors to retain part of the sample. That's the first thing, so that other investigators can look at the samples independently. And what one of the related issues to that, contamination, our first sample was collected by Jeanette McKinley in her apartment across the street from the South Tower. So the tower collapsed, the windows on her apartment broke, and the room flooded with dust. And but it was about a week later, so she left. I mean, she put a wet towel around her head, which was smart, and was able to get out of there without choking too badly, you see, on that dust. It was toxic. Now, the concern was that there'd be contamination from cleanup operations, like cutting the steel, during that week while she was gone. So what we did there is we pushed further and further back. We now have a sample that was collected within 20 minutes of the collapse of the second tower, and this was collected by Frank D'Alessio, and he went right over to see his friend Tom Breidenbach with this sample. He just scooped up some dust and actually put it in his coat pocket, which is not a bad place to put this for what we're looking for. You just don't have many molybdenum and iron spheres in your coat pocket. So anyway, he went over there. And so we have a witness just right after he collected it, and they together put it in a plastic bag. And he did this because, and all these people, they express, that I've talked to, they express, well, except one, I'll come back to him, but they express a certain sense of history and importance to these samples. So these two, Frank D'Alessio and Tom Breidenbach, spoke at Boston. I invited them up. They told how they collected it, why, you know, in detail. They sent me part of the sample. They retained part of the sample. And I've now had samples sent directly from a collector to two other scientists, one of whom is not a 9/11 truther, by the way. He's out in New Hampshire, Connecticut area. I met him in Boston. But he wanted to look at the samples, and, you know, I challenged people to look at the samples and check what we're doing, and so he wanted to do that. That's kind of sticking my neck out a bit, I guess, but that's what you'd have to do in science. Let an independent party look at it. It went directly to him from the sample collector.
And his results came out to be similar to yours.
Well, he's looking specifically at the red chips, which we haven't gotten into yet. But he said he just got this. Now, this is just, last week that he got this. He said he received it. He has looked at it. He does see the red chips that I found independently, and he will be looking at those. So,
I want to remind listeners that we're going to be taking your calls in about 10 or 15 minutes. The number is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735.
Chris, now, there's one quick point, because there's another collector of the dust who collected it because he is a PhD physicist about four blocks from ground zero. This dust sifted under the window in the Potter building, and he collected it because he wanted to see if there was asbestos in the dust, which there is, of course.
Yeah. Now, Richard, in regards to AE 9/11 Truth, you have over 200 architects and engineers represented. And one question that I'm just curious about, what goes on behind the scenes? Do a lot of the people who sign on to this are very active in trying to support a new investigation? What do these other professionals and engineers have to say? I think it's a curious question, because a lot of times when you speak a lot, and I think it's important to give people the sense of how many people are actually behind AE 9/11 Truth.
Oh, well, we have 350,000 hits on our website, so there's a lot of curious people. But the 260 architects and engineers, most of them are actively sharing with their friends. And by the way, we have over 800 others who are not particularly licensed in, as architects or engineers or degreed. And they're actively passing out our website so others can take a look. What they're most interested in, the architects and engineers, are how a 110-story building can collapse at free fall speed as if the 80,000 tons of cold, not fire, but cold underneath the jet plane impacts, cold hard steel designed to resist the load of this building for the, for its life, can collapse as if it didn't even exist. We're talking free fall speed, acceleration. In other words, the columns and beams have to be removed in the core first, within a tenth of a second of each other, or you get an asymmetrical collapse, a falling over. In the case of the Twin Towers, what you have is the 20 stories on the, in the North Tower falling not down from the point of impact, but collapsing in on itself. That is to say, the explosions are going from the point of impact up, and they and that, that mass is reduced in the first second or two to half its mass, and then 2 seconds later, it's completely destroyed, such that after that, after 4 seconds, all you have is the building tearing itself apart at free fall speed. There is no pile driver whatsoever. The building is creating this incredible mushroom cloud, an extremely explosive event where all of the columns and beams are hurled outward at 50 miles an hour, impaling themselves on buildings up to 500 feet away. And all the windows are broken within a 400-foot radius of the building. This is an incredibly explosive, energetic event. The ends of these beams are dripping with molten metal, as seen by the ironworkers. We have explosions that are visible 20, 40, and 60 stories below the ensuing collapse, in quotation marks. These are squibs or mistimed explosions that go off that have no relevant reason to be exploding. NIST tells us they're puffs of air due to the compression of the floors above, pushing the air down like a piston. But these aren't puffs of air. They're pulverized building materials ejecting out of the exact midpoints of the building at 160 to 200 feet per second. These are explosive speeds, and they're highly focalized at the midpoint, which indicates that we're not talking about a pressurized large rooms filling with air and then blowing out. We also have incredibly incredible volume of pyroclastic dust or smoke produced by these events, 10 times the volume of the building easily in the first 30 seconds of the collapse, expanding clouds, which would take easily 10 times more energy to produce just the expansion of those clouds. In other words, it's heat expanding those clouds, pyroclastic, meaning heat-induced, incredible amounts of heat that are not accounted for by the very small fire in the case of the South Tower that was going out. And so remember, these fires only burned for an hour. We have never had a high-rise building collapse due to fire ever in the history of high-rise steel frame buildings. And here on 9/11, we have three all of a sudden, and it can't be accounted for by the jet fuel, because jet fuel is just another hydrocarbon. It burns at a maximum of I use Fahrenheit as an architect, of about 12 to 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. And remember, and this jet fuel, for those who like Fahrenheit, this molten metal, I mean, it takes, steel doesn't even begin to melt until 3000 degrees. So we're missing well over 1000 degrees to produce all of this molten metal and this incredible amount of heat producing these pyroclastic clouds.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Richard Gage, founding member of AE, 911truth.org, a practicing architect for 20 years, and very much experienced with many types of building construction. I'm also speaking with Stephen Jones, professor of physics retired, who has published numerous papers in Scientific American, Nature, and Physical Review Letters. You can read his papers and others at the Journal of 911 Studies.com. That's www.journalof911studies.com. And you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the internet at kpfk.org. We'll be taking your calls at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK shortly. And we're going to continue the discussion here. There's a question I have for both of you. I recently read a post by Kevin Barrett, another 9/11 activist, where he says that there are a number of scientists and engineers that are very clear in their belief that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, but they say that they can't publicly make those claims because they don't want to ruin their careers. How many scientists and engineers do you know or have you heard of that have expressed this kind of sentiment?
Yeah. Should I start?
Yeah, sure.
Richard? Okay.
Yeah,
there are certainly a number of people that have talked to me about this and who've read my paper, for example, seen Richard's presentation and looked into this, done some study. Another good place is WTC7.net. And so as they get the information, people will tell me, I can think of several just right off, you know, they don't really want to stick their necks out and be public about it, but they realize that there's facts here that they cannot explain other than through thermite, use of explosives. And, for instance, this paper that you referred to, Chris, the on the Journal of 9/11 Studies, the paper on extremely high temperatures during the WTC destruction, that paper was reviewed by I finally called on four scientists, three PhD physicists at two universities, and they read through it and were convinced. The fourth one also thought it should be published. I don't really know if he's convinced. He didn't say one way or the other, but he did want me to come and work at his university. So, you know, because
So you got a job offer.
I had a job offer out of it, basically. And so they're associated with his reading of that paper, and he passed it along to the department chair, physics department chair, and he also pressed me to come to that university to be on the faculty. So what is that, five now? And just, you know, this paper, it's a very solid paper. You'll see that on that paper, he wanted to have his name on it. This is Dr. Ferrer. He feels very strongly that there's something strange, that is, the official story is not correct, and that the evidence is consistent with the use of thermite. It could be various forms of explosives used, but this would be one of them. He did not want to be filmed, however, by BBC when they came around. You know, and so, you see what I mean? People have various degrees of how much neck sticking out they want to do. But right. But yes, there are a number of people that I've talked to who are persuaded and convinced by the data and are trying to do something about it in one way or another. But, you know, are concerned about their jobs. I mean, I was offered early retirement fairly, shall we say, persuasively, which I accepted. I accepted early retirement, but then I've had this nice job offer since. And I haven't taken it up yet, by the way, because various personal reasons. But it's been quite a ride. And, yeah, a lot of people coming out of the woodwork. I had an architect, too, Richard, who wrote to me. She's in Texas. And she said, this was early on. She said she just would really lose her job. I mean, she was sure she would, but she very strongly supported what I was doing. At my first paper, this is back a couple years ago now, a year and a half ago, first paper on the collapse of the tower. So, yeah, there are a lot of people like that that are very supportive but tend to be reluctant to speak out.
And I want to remind listeners again, the number is 818-985-5735, and I'd really like to encourage somebody who supports the official story and to ask questions.
Sure.
Please call in if you want to ask either of our guests today any questions. That's 818-985-5735. And for both of you, given your professional experience, your research, and the research of others, is it accurate to say that given the evidence for the controlled demolition hypothesis, Do you believe that the logistics required to bring these buildings down would necessitate some kind of official sanctioning or some kind of official involvement? In other words, does the evidence negate the ability of 19 hijackers to prepare and arrange the logistics for a controlled demolition?
Well, that's probably true. What's more true is that given that these are the three of the most highly secure buildings outside of the Pentagon, that it's extremely unlikely that Al-Qaeda could have gotten access, even if they had the skills, knowledge, and materials necessary. So we're really talking about now a very different scenario where Al-Qaeda is nothing but a group of patsies. In fact, there seems to be two Osamas, a fat one and a skinny one. The skinny one does not take credit for the attacks, and the fat one takes all kinds of credit, very diametrically opposed. And so that's if people Google Fatty Osama, you can actually see the video that the Defense Department put out as the supposed of a smoking gun that they found in a house in Afghanistan during the invasion.
Yeah, these are very serious questions. Of course, as you immediately take the next step, going from the physics and the chemistry and the engineering of the destruction of these World Trade Center towers and World Trade Center 7, and then take the next step. Well, what does that mean? Who is behind it? I think I would refer to some papers that have carefully looked at the issues and the evidence, besides the science evidence. This is a paper by Professor Peter Dale Scott and Professor David Ray Griffin. They both have excellent papers in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Those two come to mind immediately. Andrew Marshall, his paper also, Professor McQueen, I think all approach and answer this vital issue. And, you know, rather than trying to paraphrase others' research, which, you know, they've done a fantastic job, I tend to refer people to those papers. But all of them agree that there was something in addition to, certainly beyond Al-Qaeda.
I'd like to take a listener call. And for the listeners on the phone, we've got a lot of calls, so the easiest way to get to as many of them is to be quick. And let's go to Carlos and Carson. Quick question for Richard Gage or Dr. Jones.
Well, yes, either one. I understand the controlled demolition who picked up the debris also specializes in demolitions.
Right.
And number two, of course, another observation is that 2 weekends prior or a week prior to 9/11, the cameras were turned off the buildings during the weekends, and what a wonderful opportunity to let the perpetrators in. I wonder who was allowed into those buildings in those weekends. And, of course, one of the Bush people was in charge of security. And just another observation, I understand that on Building 7, Enron's records were there, housed there, and Enron was undergoing an investigation.
Yep.
Any comments on this?
Who wants to take this?
I'll take a quick stab. It's true that the firm Controlled Demolition Incorporated, headed by Mark Loiseau, was given the contract to clean up the World Trade Center, as well, by the way, as the Oklahoma City bombing. And he is certainly somebody who should be asked some very pointed questions in an unimpeachable investigation with subpoena power, which is what the architects and engineers for 9/11 are demanding. We're not waiting. We've joined with Scholars for Truth and Justice, STJ911.org, in order to create the framework for this investigation, which we've been carrying on now for a few years. So we're putting it all together so that somebody, maybe an international body, maybe the New York 9/11 Initiative, that the voters of New York are voting in November on, this can be a viable body of evidence, the beginning of that. Your next question had to do with power down. Indeed, we have a story
from Scott Forbes, who worked for one of the high finance companies in the one of the two towers. He said half of that tower was powered down over the weekend. It had never happened before. The weekend prior to 9/11, and he saw people coming in with all kinds of wires and so forth. Ostensibly, they were. They said they were putting in new infrastructure. Yeah. Next, you mentioned the security situation. The 6 weeks prior to 9/11, not only did the entire World Trade Center complex turn over from public hands, from the Port Authority, over to Larry Silverstein and other private developers, but the security company changed as well with that, and indeed Securicom, who has on its board of directors Wirt Walker III and Marvin Bush,
yeah.
was on the board of directors of that. And indeed, Enron did lose thousands of files related to hundreds of cases, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that they were pursuing against companies like Enron and WorldCom. So there's lots of questions that need to be asked.
Okay, let's go to Frank and Ventura. Question or comment for our guest today?
Yeah, hello. It's an honor to be on the air and in such great company. And I have a quick question. Being architects and engineers, those buildings are built based on the laws of physics, which is part of the order of the universe. And how do you deal with people that that have these excuses for how they came down as far as they defy the laws of physics and all of the principles that you people live and work and build by? And another thing on top of that is there's a $1 million reward for anybody that can prove that the Bush story is right. How would you approach people that defy the order of the universe, basically?
Dr. Jones, how about that on the physics?
Yeah, let me... That's a very good point. In my first paper, I talk about conservation of momentum and energy in the collapse of these buildings. As you look at, for instance, the collapse of Building 7, the roof, the southwest corner is what I looked at, falls in 6.5 seconds, plus minus 0.2, and I timed it with students, and we got a good measurement on that. Well, free fall time is 6.0, so, I mean, you compare, it's almost free fall time, and that's what you find with controlled demolition. Well, in order to conserve, so momentum, what is that? You're driving your car and you bump something. I think we've all done that. Well, it slows you down, and that's because momentum is conserved, basically, is a fundamental physics principle involved here. Similarly, with the roof of the World Trade Center 7, as that starts to move, if it hits material below, it's going to have to slow down. This is something Richard referred to earlier. Several papers in the Journal of 9/11 Studies about this. The material, the roof doesn't slow down. It continues to fall as if material is being moved out of the way. And that's what happens with explosive demolition. Material is literally moved out of the way. So you still conserve momentum and get a collapse or a destruction at free fall speed. The towers also show destruction at nearly free fall speed, so the same principles apply there. I might add that NIST was asked, well, did you consider momentum and energy conservation as you analyzed? And they and their response was quite funny. They said, well, as the airplanes, the jets, hit the towers, we considered conservation of energy and momentum. Well, that may be, but that's skirting the real issue, which is the collapse of the towers. I just have to throw one thing in on that. We've filed, I and a bunch of others, filed a request for correction with NIST because we found errors in their report, and they came back and they said, and this is published in the Journal 9/11 Studies, their letter back to us, they said, we are unable to explain the total collapse of these buildings. I mean, you know, after all these years and work and millions of dollars, tens of millions spent, they finally admit that they cannot explain the total collapse of these buildings. I just thought that was remarkable, and I wanted to say, well, tell the world that now, you know, confess, you know, mea culpa. Please, you know, let's get this word out.
In fact, because they couldn't explain it, and probably for a couple of other reasons, they stopped their entire investigation at the instant that the initiation of collapse begins.
which was about an hour after the South Tower was hit by the plane. They do not have any structural analysis or data about what happens after that. In other words, the structural behavior of the building during the actual collapse, the progression of this initial failure. They merely have one half of a page of speculation that has no supporting data whatsoever, that simply says that the weight of the mass above could not be absorbed by the building below in by deformation of its members. In other words, it's obvious that it fell down, so we didn't need to go there.
Right.
That's what they say in their question and answer period.
Let's go to John in Oxnard. Welcome to Indie Media on Air. Quick question or comment for Dr. Jones or Richard Gage.
Just a quick comment. You know, on 9/11, just a few hours after everything had happened, I, being a lay person, knowing nothing about controlled demolition, knew that something wasn't right about the way these things fell. And how neatly and quickly they fell. Just the fact that Tower 7 came down is just enough alone to make anybody with a modicum of intelligence wonder, you know?
Right.
Now, in terms of them placing explosives over the weekend and stuff like that, there's no way that they would be able to wire up those buildings within a few days. This is something that was planned for years.
At least months. I would have to agree with your comments. Yeah. Yeah, but looking at Building 7 come down is very striking. That's what got me interested in this. And I'm pleased. I asked BBC, are you really going to show the collapse of Building 7? And they said, yes, we are. There's a special coming up here.
Well, they spent about 2.5 hours interviewing me, and I gave them nothing but the physical evidence this weekend. And our structural, and one of our six structural engineers and one of our three fire protection engineers was also interviewed. So they seem serious about taking this on, but we'll see what they actually put out. We expect their documentary on World Trade Center 7 to be shown in May.
We shall see.
Yeah, we hope.
real fast. Is this a growing movement? I mean, I just want to see this thing explode. You know, be able to just, you know, everybody's worried about Britney Spears and the Super Bowl. You know?
Yeah. Well,
anyway,
thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you. I'm encouraged with the growth of Architects and Engineers, 9/11 Truth, and also the Scholars for Truth and Justice, Richard mentioned. I'm actually in both groups and working with people investigating these issues. We're trying to get papers published in scientific publications. That's another trick because, frankly, the political issues, I guess, they just seem to jump up so easily. But, yes, it certainly does seem to be growing. That's what you look at Architects and Engineers now, over 1,000 total members. I mean, that's a rapid growth.
And we're expecting 5,000 members by September 11th, 2008, including 1,000 architects and engineers. And so we're pulling out all the stops to raise everybody's awareness. We're going to architecture and engineering firms, buying them lunch, making the presentation, because even a sixth grader can understand. For instance, if you hold with a large crane a 20-story building way up high, 80 stories over the ground, and then next to it, you have the same 20-story building, but you put it over the top of an 80-story building, and you let go of both of them at once. Which one's going to hit the ground, the one that has nothing but air below it, or the one that has 80,000 tons of structural steel that it has to go through to hit the ground first? A sixth grader understands this, and when I present this to architects, they finally get it, and they sign on, and they tell their friends about it, and that's why we're growing so fast.
I want to remind listeners that my two guests today, Richard Gage and Stephen Jones, will be appearing in Los Angeles on Saturday, February 23rd at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, located at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. Seating will begin at 5. Cynthia McKinney will be there to address the crowd and give her support to a new investigation. And you can get more information by calling 805-653-1588. We've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to try and get a few more calls in. Mark in Pasadena, a quick question or comment for Richard Gage or Stephen Jones.
Yeah, basically sort of along the same lines that the previous caller mentioned, that those charges, you know, if they were present, and it, from all the evidence, you know, there's with all this concrete evidence, these materials were there. What's to say that they're not just actually incorporated in the structure so that in case of a catastrophic failure caused by a, let's say, like a more powerful truck bomb like was attempted previously, and to prevent the building from going down asymmetrically and taking out not only the building but, you know, a whole bunch of other buildings and a whole bunch of other infrastructure stuff. Whether this stuff is, has anyone ever thought of that?
Richard, do you design buildings with bombs in them to explode?
No. In fact, I've actually heard that this building might have had explosives in it to begin with, and that just sounds ludicrous. They might have done it on purpose to keep buildings from hurting other buildings, make it come down, or that it was designed without bombs, but to fall straight down through itself so that it wouldn't hurt other buildings. These concepts are ludicrous, and no structural engineer anywhere, not even this, the official story, will support them in any manner. It really is a ludicrous idea.
I agree. It keeps coming up, though, that question. Just real quickly, insurance money that was paid out, the insurance companies would sure like to know if these buildings were brought down in that way instead of the official story, which is a fire and damage, of course, because they paid out over $4 billion in insurance money.
Billion with a B.
With a B, right. So they would sure like to know if these were deliberately brought down.
Let's go to one more call. James in Santa Barbara, welcome to Indie Media on Air. Quick question or comment.
Yeah, just really quick. First off, I want to know if you were to accept that this was a conspiracy. But in the beginning of the show, I heard, I don't remember the announcer's name, but...
It's Chris, that's me.
Sorry about that. But if you were to accept that it was a conspiracy, but you said that you were against the xenophobic turn that it takes, my question is, how far to what extent would you expect the conspiracy discussion to go?
Well, hold on. I just want to clarify my comments. I didn't say the conspiracy takes a xenophobic turn. What I said was is that when those elements pop up within the movement, that's problematic.
Right. When they say that Silverstein and it's the Jews and whatever. But what I'm asking is, to what extent would you suggest that the conspiracy would go? And secondly, I just want to ask, if you do have if you can actually prove to the American people that there was a controlled demolition, what do you really expect in American society to change as a result? Or what outcome do you think is conceivable? Do you really think that you would be able to call elements that would obviously
We're almost about to wrap up, and I got your question. Let's let one of the guests handle that.
Let me try real quickly. I know we're almost out of time. The journal discusses some of these issues. What can we do? As Richard mentioned, we are conducting an investigation, but we're seeking an official investigation with subpoena power to bring. Congress is charged with this oversight function. They really should take this on, but you'd bring in scientists, and then you'd bring in Mineta, have his testimony as a young man. He was referring to Dick Cheney. He was talking about, you know, under oath and in this place. They're whistleblowers.
We've got to wrap it up.
Yeah,
I'm really sorry.
Yeah, I understand. So we just need that official investigation. You can't answer all the questions just with science.
All right. Well,
I'd like to encourage all the listeners to go to the website and get the information, ae911truth.org.
ae911truth.org and www.journalof911studies.com.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for joining me today on Indie Media on Air. I really appreciate you coming.
Real pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. And you can see Dr. Jones and Richard Gage in Los Angeles on Saturday, February 23rd. For more information, you can call the station desk, and we'll have that information. I want to thank producer Christine Blasdale and engineer D'Angelo Jones for producing today's show. Thanks, and I'm out.
And you've been listening to Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. You can visit our website at kpfk.org, where you can hear us live worldwide, as well as listen to past shows. Keep it tuned to your grassroots station, because Voices from the Frontline is coming up after a special minute of programming by the Beatles, followed by news headlines.
KPFK is testing its emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. KPFK serves the greater Los Angeles area.
I'm KPFK senior producer Alan Minsky here in Master Control. In a few moments at midnight Greenwich Mean Time, NASA will be transmitting the Beatles song Across the Universe via its Deep Space Network. Across the universe, as it were. At exactly the same time, the Beatles and their extended family, including Paul McCartney, Yoko Ono, and Olivia Harrison, all of whom have been friends of this radio station in various ways at various times, are asking fans across the world to play Across the Universe, which, as has been noted, is a song of peace. It is now 3 minutes.